Welcome back to the Macam in the Middle podcast, and this is not after another Sunderland League game and not another Sunderland League defeat. It is something slightly different, and one thing that always comes up is news surrounding Sunderland, whether it's about a manager, whether it's about a player, or just ongoing happenings at the club, and everything always focuses on that as opposed to the people who are the ones reporting it. So today is something different. I'm joined by James Copley, who many of you will know as one of the journalists at Sunderland Echo, who is responsible for passing on that reliable information that goes on around the club, a lot of which does cause a lot of negativity recently, which we'll get onto. So first and foremost, how are you getting on?
Yeah, good, thank you. It's a shame about Sunderland's most recent result against Huddersfield Town, but we'll go again on Saturday, hopefully.
We will, which is, of course, against Birmingham. We'll have a podcast to talk about that one as well.
Tony Mowbray, what could go wrong? What could go wrong?
We'll get started straight into it then, and obviously, as I mentioned before, you are a journalist, you are a Sunderland journalist. Was that always what you had planned for your future when you were younger, to specifically cover Sunderland as well?
No, not really, to be honest. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I was always really interested in sport and football, particularly. I was Sunderland daft as a kid. I had a season ticket for a long time. And really sort of what piqued my interest in sports journalism was actually podcasting, because I remember getting an iPhone pretty early on, and there was like podcasts from BBC Radio 5 Live and Talk Sport and whatnot. And I was like, I couldn't understand how that was a job, but I didn't really know how you got into it. So I sort of finished school with very average grades. I went to college, did politics, history and sociology. Again, got very average grades. So after my 2 years at Bede, I started working in a bar, and I took a year out before I wasn't going to go to university, but after a year working in a bar, I decided I would go to university in Swansea to study history. So it wasn't even really on my radar at that point. I just wanted to get out of Sunderland for a little bit. I have family down in Wales. I liked history. It was a good opportunity to sort of to get a degree, to get some experience doing stuff under my belt, learn how to write. And then it sort of got towards the end of this degree, and, you know, you've been like living in a different place for a little while, and you've got your friends, and they were all starting to like talk about what jobs they were going to get. And a lot of them were being like teachers and like postgraduate jobs. And I was just sort of sat there thinking like, I hadn't really considered what I was going to do for the rest of my life. And this is a bit concerning, because I don't particularly want to be a history teacher. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I think that would be an amazing job, but it just wasn't for me at the time. And then some of the other avenues people were going down, I was just a bit like, right, I really do not fancy that. And I've always enjoyed work. I've worked since I was a kid, like paper rounds in a bar and stuff like that. I've always liked work. So like enjoying work was important to me. And then it was through actually my friend, Michael Luff, who I don't see too much of anymore, but he's on the Wise Men Say podcast quite regularly. And me and him were sort of talking, and he was writing for Roker Report. And I was doing an essay on Raish Carter for a sports history module I was doing. So Mickey read it and said, that's good, you should send it a Roker Report. And I started doing a bit of sort of like just fan stuff really for them towards the back end of my history degree. And then started looking into a sports journalism master's, which luckily enough, they did one in Sunderland. So I managed to pass my history degree. I got onto the sports journalism master's sort of as a bit of a Hail Mary, really, because I was like, if I'm going to get a job for the rest of my life, like as a history teacher or something, I can do that, or I can try and do something that I would really, really enjoy, that really sort of is my passion. So I thought, I'll give it a go. I'll work as hard as I can. I'll do the master's degree. I'll do all of the stuff that comes with it, all of the freelance and the free work. And if it doesn't work out, then at least I tried. So it was, I sort of came to the idea very late, but once I sort of fixated on it, I was all in. But that, like that master's year was a rough year, because it was so tough, like massively tough. Like I had a bit of a mental breakdown towards the end of it, to be honest. I had to get my dissertation deferred about 2 or 3 months, and I actually ended up graduating a little bit later. Because I was sort of, I moved out of my mum's house. I was trying to work a couple of jobs while doing the master's, which is a really intense course. while sort of doing all of the extra work on the outside. So thankfully, the university were really understanding. Neil Farrington, who obviously teaches you, really, really helped. People like John Price and Neil McFarlane, Carol Watson, all of those people were really, really good. And I managed to eventually get it finished. And then, I was sort of messing around a bit after that and doing bits and pieces of work here and there. And that's how I got into it.
Yeah. And one thing that people probably don't realise, a lot of people probably think these journalists just kind of spawn out of nowhere and just start talking about football. But there's a lot of work that goes into it. And I mean, your day-to-day kind of role, there's a lot of unseen work to it as well.
Yeah, it's very involved, actually. And it's like very multifaceted as well. I think what I sort of really reflect on is the work that I did before I actually got my job here now. Like the amount of free work that I did, I mean, a lot of it was really enjoyable and I got a lot of opportunities because of it. So obviously Roker Report was the website that I first started writing for, with people like Conor Bromley and stuff like that. That was really exciting at the time. And it is still a really good place to sort of go and cut your teeth. And I did little bits for Wise Men Say, which was really helpful learning the sort of podcast and stuff. I wrote for ALS a little bit as well. I got a little bit of work with Sun FM, which was like post-match interviews with Jack Ross at the time. And all of this was for free. And it was really good and really beneficial because I got a lot out of it and managed to learn a lot of skills. But when I was trying to sort of live and find the money to live whilst work, like a quote unquote normal job, and then all of that sort of stuff. So that was really tough, like getting into it that way. But I mean, really fun as well. I must add that like it was a grind, but met some really good people and got some good opportunities. And then, like got the job at the Echo, and for the first sort of 6 months was just completely chasing me tail because I didn't really know what I was doing. And it was really, really hard. Like there was loads of stuff that goes on. Like day to day, so like my day to day sort of hour to hour job now, and this is like similar to the other lads that work with us, is you have content to write, whether that's around a press conference or whatever news is happening during the day, but then that all needs to be socialed. Just getting an article up to web is quite involved because you've got to write like 3 or 4 different headlines now. And I'll not bore everybody with like the proper details, but there's one main headline that goes on Google, then there's another headline that will show on your socials, then there's another little headline that shows on the websites, and you've got to make sure your article's like got an image, that it's set up for Google, so there's different links in there. It's got to be a certain size. There's different sizes that you've got to sort of adhere to, like extra small, small, medium, large articles. Every article needs a video. There's all of that sort of stuff. So that's just one article, and then you've got to social that on Facebook, Twitter. Like if there's a graphic that needs doing with that, you know, there's all of that sort of stuff to do. Like video editing's a massive thing these days, so like getting a video on Dailymotion, YouTube, editing it, putting the intro, the outro, filming it. Like it's quite time consuming, really.
Yeah. And it does. People only see the final product as well.
No, that's true. That's true. And it's very diverse set of skills. I mean, even podcasting is a complete art form in itself. And to get like a podcast on streaming live on Facebook and Twitter and YouTube, and then have it on a podcast feed. There's all sorts of things that come into the job, and I'm probably forgetting things as well. You know, you've got to manage your, well, my boss tends to do this mostly, but like it all does fall under all of our responsibilities, is like managing the homepage for the Sunderland Echo, which means you've got to make sure your content's showing. And you're working from home during this as well, so you communicate back and forth with your team. And you know, Phil Smith, my colleague, his job differs slightly from me, so he'll be off up the academy, and then he's getting back from the academy, talking to the manager, and you know, he's got like things to write and deadlines to fit, deadlines to hit. So it is massively involved, I think, because you're not just doing one thing, you're being sort of pulled here, there and everywhere. You're trying to keep an eye on like the news, you know, like SAFC news now. You try to keep an eye on social media to see if anything's come up, like during a transfer window. You can imagine it's just it's all sorts of chaos, or like, you know, if Sunderland draw Newcastle in the FA Cup and then Sunderland decide to hand the Black Cats bar over to to the arch enemy, like things get like, you know, massively intense. So, but it's good, like, for to be a Sunderland fan from Sunderland, it's amazing, really. Like, I have to pinch myself sometimes, and it doesn't really feel like work a lot of the time because you want to do it, which is key for me, I think.
Yeah. And obviously, sports journalism kind of as a whole is definitely getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And like you mentioned there, podcasts are becoming, you know, more normal now. You've got lots of people writing for lots of different news sites. And if you ask this question to 10 different journalists, you probably get 10 different answers. But there's lots of people who want to get involved in journalism as a whole, not just sports journalism. But if you had to give advice to people who were looking to follow a similar route to what you're currently involved in now, what would your advice be?
My advice would be work as hard as you possibly can and try and make a good impression on the right people. Don't be shy. I think you do have to be outgoing in a sense, because, you know, you will have to bother people. You'll have to bother editors. You sort of have to fight to get noticed in a way. Building your social media profile is obviously really, really important, but you need to try and do that whilst remaining professional. Yeah, I think hard work is always the key. When I look back, I think that was the separator for me, because I'm no more talented than about 10 other people that I know that did the same courses as some of them will have been more talented than me, to be honest. And it hasn't worked out for them. And I can't speak for them, obviously. But I think for me, what pulled me through was the hard work and the consistency of the hard work as well. So I was offering the Echo, like the match reports from women's games on a Sunday, because I was going up there really regularly at the time. And I kind of spotted the gap in the coverage that there wasn't any there. So I thought, right, I'm going up there anyway. I'll write a report and send it in. And
I think that's one of the main things as well, is to find something that not anyone else is doing. And once you've got that role, then people will come to you for it.
No, absolutely. And it's funny because, like, sometimes, like, in the past, there's been work experiences years ago that have come out of the Echo and they're like, oh, did you do, like, play ratings from the game last night? And it's like, well, yeah, like, we did do play ratings. Like, one, how can you not see that? And, like, two, that's, you know, you need to sort of think a bit outside the box, if that makes sense. But, yeah, I just think getting your head down, working hard, listening to your lecturers is always really key. You know, the lecturers at Sunderland Uni have got some really good war stories, and I think just being open to different stuff as well. Like, I didn't just cover football. I covered a little bit of boxing. I like to think I could, you know, do news journalism as well, if I needed to, just because of the course at Sunderland Uni. Again, I think social media profile is really important. And honestly, if I was to give advice specifically to somebody who wanted to become, like, a journalist covering Sunderland or sport, the fanzine route is a really good way to go, because you'll meet good people, you'll meet good contacts, people that want to help you, and you almost sort of get not a blank canvas, because obviously there's like established things and established way of doing things that people have, but you can sort of make it what you want, and you can go in there with ideas, and you know, you can collaborate with people who have been doing it and who have got experience. And they'll be able to pass contacts to you and stuff like that. So that really helped me, I think, just sort of like learning about different things. I mean, the fanzine scene's fraught with like politics and complications as well, but like navigating that's quite interesting and can be, and you've got to sort of keep your head. But I really enjoyed the sort of, in hindsight, maybe at the time I didn't think I did, but I really enjoyed like Rogue Report, ALS, Wise Men Say. It was really beneficial for me, like really, really beneficial. So I would always recommend sort of going down that route.
Yeah. Obviously, fast forward to now, you are a Sunderland supporter covering Sunderland. How have you been able to kind of separate your love for the club and being a supporter and keeping that separate from obviously not working for the club, but, you know, covering the club in a professional manner?
With great difficulty, to be honest. My boss, Richard Maneer, often says, we're journalists first and then fans second. And I agree with him. But whenever he says that, I sort of sit there thinking, like, well, no, I'm a fan first and a journalist second. Like, and I'm constantly having this sort of battle with myself. And going to the match, obviously, was a massive part of my life in the... in the guise that I went to the match. So going with your friends and, you know, doing whatever, having a couple of pints and, you know, walking over the bridge and arriving at the ground 5 minutes before kickoff and complaining about the turnstiles and all of that sort of stuff. But that all changes. So you've got to be professional. You're there to do a job at the end of the day. So it is difficult. And obviously when it's your city, when it's your people, when it's your club, when it's your fan base, it is really tough sometimes. And you do have to be sort of more level headed. Like Phil and Joe, the people I work with, and Rich, they probably pull it off better than me, just because of the type of sort of people they are, which is great, because I think they probably rein me in at times, which is much appreciated. But I think it definitely comes with experience as well. So when I'm nearly 5 years into the job now, and the way I was maybe like 4 years ago is completely different to now. I think you just sort of with, you know, age become like comes a bit of experience and wisdom, so to speak. So I mean it is tough, because when you see the it does affect you as well. Like it's like Sunderland's my life, do you know what I mean? It's my job, but it's also what I sort of consume in my spare time.
That's the thing, isn't it? On a weekend, if you're not covering Sunderland, your then go-to thing would be to watch Sunderland.
Yeah, you do have to be careful, because you'll get burnout. So like I wasn't rotated on the night of the Huddersfield game. I worked a 7-3, and then the two lads went to the match. So that's sort of like I finished my shift, but then I'm still like in my mind, I'm still on the clock, if that makes sense. Just because you're sort of thinking of the game and all that stuff. But yeah, it is all encompassing. You do have to be sort of careful not to get burnt out, because it means so much to you. And I think Sunderland being such an intense city as well, and the people are so intense, when like I'll have conversations in the street with people that I know, and like the first thing they'll talk about will be Sunderland, and it's brilliant, and I love that, and it's great that everyone's so passionate. But like from a personal perspective, sometimes you just sort of like bloody hell, like I've spoken about this quite a lot, and you know, and it's great because people do want to talk and chat about the football, and that's class. But sometimes like, you know, case in point, people will come up to me and be like, oh, have you heard about this, and what do you think of this? And you do get a bit sort of burnt out by it, and it is really, really hard to clock off sometimes. But thankfully I've got like good family and friends that always take the dog out for a walk, and we have like a caravan in Teesdale, which I spend a lot of time in the summer, so that helps to unwind. But I wouldn't have it any other way, to be honest, because I think that's where the value of my journalism comes from, really, is that it comes from a place of passion and a place of wanting the best for the club's fans, the club and the city at the end of the day. And I don't think, I often speak to people and they say, do you think you'd be able to cover another club? And I think I would be able to with the skills I've gained over the years, but like, I don't know if I would have the same passion for, you know, Yeovil than I would Sunderland.
Yeah. And obviously I think it's kind of a testament that every journalist would share, is that when things are going well at the club you support, well, at the club you're covering, sorry, it makes things a lot easier. And on the flip side, when things are going bad at the club you're covering, it makes it a lot harder. And added on to that, when it's also the club you support, it's probably even harder than it would be if you didn't support them, because your job is to report the news. And especially with Sunderland recently, a lot of the news that you have to report is stuff that the fans don't like, but you have to post it.
Yeah, it is tough. I think there's I don't know, it's weird, isn't it? Because when things are going good, everyone's sort of euphoric and everybody gets on. And this isn't a war betide me or like, you know, us poor journalists or anything, because it's not. But I do feel like occasionally, say if things are going bad, everybody will turn around and be like, well, why don't you ask this? Why don't you ask that? And hold the club to account. And 9 times out of 10, these questions are getting asked, but people either haven't seen or they just didn't like the answer. So I think, but then you see fans arguing with each other and this and that, and you know, this fanzine has a row with this fanzine, or this fanzine isn't Flavour of the Month, so all like a couple of fans pile on them. And I think everybody just tends to get tetchy, and social media amplifies that. So it's nothing I try not to take it too personal, but it does hurt sometimes, especially when you know you're working in good faith. And I think the thing is with journalism as well is that, and a lot of people's analysis, and what me personally, I'm always open to sort of constructive criticism, but a lot of the analysis of what we do and what my colleagues do, they'll sort of just lump everybody under the media umbrella, when in reality, everybody's an individual working for individual organisations with different opinions, different feelings, different approaches, different way of doing things. So you get somebody coming up to you and saying, well, why aren't you holding the club to account? And it's like, well, you know, so-and-so has held the club to account here or here, and you try to point towards these things, and then it, you have the conversation, it turns out that their gripe isn't even really with you or what you've done, it's with somebody else, or like with the club, essentially, a lot of the time. And I think Phil will probably get this a lot more than me, but say sometimes, I don't know, he's been speaking to, let's say, Simon Grayson back in the day or something, and he's been asked a question and he's provided an answer that Phil's then had to publish on the website and then put on social media, and like suddenly every fan is like really, really annoyed. And it can sometimes feel like they're annoyed with you because obviously you're getting the quote retweets, the retweets, the replies. You know, some of the language is quite
to say the least.
Yes, you could say that. So it's, you do feel like everyone's sort of piling on you, and you're like, you can feel a bit defensive, and you'd be like, whoa, what's going on? But you have to take a step back and realize that maybe it's not, you know, you that they're annoyed at. But I think that obviously social media we'll talk about a little bit later, I'm sure, but I don't think that helps with a lot of things. But I can't even remember what the original question was now. Oh, yes. negativity and toughness. Yeah. No, it is tough. It can be tough, but I think you do learn that not to take social media so personally, which is, I think, is something I struggled with when I first came into the job, because, like, for me, I had this sort of idealistic utopian thing in my head that, like, all Sunderland fans would just agree and it would be brilliant. And, like, maybe it's because I was a Sunderland fan, everyone would just be like, all right, okay. But life just doesn't work like that, and people will disagree. And actually, that's good and that's healthy. And as long as it doesn't sort of cross over into being, you know, really, you know, sort of toxic or nasty, it's good and it's fair game. And as I say, I never mind being, like, constructively criticised. I think that's fine. But come with an understanding of the role and the job, I think... A lot of the conversations I have, you sort of sit down with people and chat with them, and they may have had a gripe, but when you actually explain the sort of process behind it, and, you know, perhaps they've missed something or whatever, 9 times out of 10, it sort of ends quite amicably, really. So yeah. I think a lot of things are just misunderstandings, really.
Yeah. And I think one word that I'm going to throw out there is a word that you probably see quite a lot, and it might be a word you don't like too much, is the word exclusive. You'll see it all the time, and it's probably the main word that kind of sparks some massive reaction across Sunderland fans, especially because you'll see the word exclusive and automatically assume it's right. And, you know, 9 times out of 10 it might be, 9 times out of 10 it might not be. But from your perspective, you'll see other journalists, not necessarily just Sunderland journalists, but, you know, they'll post an exclusive, and you might have the same information, but you don't know that it's 100% accurate. You're not entirely sure where it's come from. You have to double check your sources, but they've already posted it. Turns out it's correct. They might have jumped the gun a bit, but they get all the plaudits for something you might have known before them.
I think that you've stitched us up here. I think this exclusive issue has got a couple of sort of angles. I think, like, during a transfer window, I don't think it's harsh to say that everybody's badge and everything is an exclusive. I don't think that's right, personally, for me. So, you know, so I'm not going to name any websites, but a couple of, like, the maybe's websites that aren't based covering Sunderland full time, who cover maybe a lot of clubs or just transfers or something like that, they'll come out with a piece and, like, hammer it as an exclusive when actually it's been reported elsewhere first. There's always that to consider. I think if you use the word exclusive too often, it just dilutes it. I don't think there are many sort of real true exclusives at the moment. So, for instance, I did an interview the other day with an ex-Sunderland player, Carl Lawson, who I went to school with, and I didn't badge it as an exclusive because I didn't really feel the need to, like, whack exclusive in caps lock. Nobody else had the quotes. He'd only spoken to me, but I just didn't feel that it was right. I think some of it is sort of trying to drum up interest in an article, which is fair enough.
Yeah.
But then, you know, if you're badging things exclusive, like, you've got to get it right as well. I mean, you have to get all of your stories right. Of course you do. But I don't know. I just think the overuse of that word can hinder it and dilute it, really. And you do have to be, just in the second part of your question, you do have to be absolutely sure when you're posting stuff as well. So is there regret when, like, another website sort of publishes information that you've had an idea about? Possibly a little bit, yeah, but I think I would regret it more if I jumped the gun without being 100% sure and then it wasn't right. So a good example, actually, to make it specific, would be, it was before Stoke, that Alex Pritchard decided not to play.
Yeah.
So a lot, well, I certainly had heard rumours that was going to happen from a decent source that doesn't usually let me down. But given it was like a couple of hours before the game, given that that is a huge story, I couldn't just take, you know, one sort of source's word for it. So then you go around and you have a chat with a few people, a few other journalist colleagues and stuff like that. You're trying to get it stood up. They've maybe heard similar things, but it's all sort of half news and he said, she said. It's nothing. It was concrete. It was a concrete source, but it's such a big story that you just sort of think, if you put that out and get it wrong, you know, your credibility is going to take a massive hit. It's like a couple of hours before the game. Let's just see how it develops. And it turns out that it was absolutely true. But because I couldn't get it sort of like double, triple, quadruple sourced, I just wasn't comfortable doing it. And I think that's something I've learned. And it's a good way to operate, that unless you are really sure, then there's really actually no benefit in publishing. And I think especially as well, I think I see a lot when it comes to transfer stories, I see a lot of articles from other websites where it's quite clearly just one side of the argument. So they've spoken to an agent of a player and they've been told something or briefed, and then that comes out and it's published without maybe having taken that information to the club or trying to get a different perspective, because there's always two sides to every story. And I don't think you should just become, you know, PR for an agent, essentially. So, I mean, there's a lot that goes on behind those sorts of things. And I mean, at the end of the day, I think the trouble comes with, and this includes, you know, myself and my company as well, is that, you know, bringing the news, it does come at a cost, and we're all paid salaries, and, you know, it's a business at the end of the day. So you do have to think about getting page views. You do have to think about how long people spend on your website and all of that sort of stuff. And the best way to ensure that people come to your website and stay on your website is, especially in football, is if you have good transfer stories. But
that for me
should never come at the cost of being wrong or just publishing, you know, one side of the story. And that's something, to be fair, that Phil Smith has sort of drummed into me over the years, because we work sort of like closely sometimes on stuff that I hear or he hears, and we'll sort of, I'll come to him with something and say, what do you think? And he'll say, well, we need to tread carefully. It's only one side of the story. Let's see if we can get a double sourced. Let's, you know, see if we can get the other side and get a better, complete, more wholesome picture. And that benefits fans at the end of the day. And I think it's really, really important that you try and do that where you can.
Yeah, I think we briefly already touched on it, but when it comes to writing these stories, how many times do you actually have to fact check these things and, you know, get a second source, get a third source, get a fourth source? Because especially with some stories, even if one word of a sentence is wrong, that can have major implications as to the point you're trying to make, which, you know, leads you open to a lot of different things.
Yeah, I think the hard and fast rule is like always double source where you can. I think that's the best thing to do. You do have to fact check everything. You do have to make sure everything's accurate. So, for instance, there was a really long read on Chris Rigg that I did recently about his contract and his transfer situation. And it was a very, very small mistake, to be fair, and got it sorted. But the rules on, so he signed a scholarship deal now, which means he's sort of at Sunderland for 2 years from the day he signed it, but it's not a professional deal. I thought that he could actually go and leave tomorrow if he wanted. I thought that was the scholarship rule, but it's not. if a club came in for him, they would have to agree a fee.
Yeah.
But it's really weird with scholarship rules because they're not actually written down anywhere. So I wrote it, and obviously this piece was like 1,200 words, and then, you know, a couple of people had a look over it, and then Phil again came back to us and said, I don't think that's the rule. So like give us a second to double check or whatever, and we came back and just changed it slightly. But I mean, that could have caused hell on, really, if you think about it. Like, oh, Chris Rink can leave for nothing tomorrow. And it wasn't something that I'd written in bad faith, and it didn't mean that my whole article was rubbish, but it's just sometimes you've got to be extremely careful, especially with wording as well, because, you know, I think, like, especially, you know, football fans, Sunderland fans, you're always looking at the wording, and if something's worded suggesting that somebody's unhappy or somebody's going to leave or something, like, people will jump on that, and rightly so. So yeah, you do have to be careful.
Yeah.
And for me as well, the last thing I'd ever want to do is be misleading Sunderland fans or accused of misleading Sunderland fans. There's been one or two very small occasions where, like, somebody's come up to us and said, like, oh, you're just, like, shit stirring or something, and I'm like, yeah. I live in Sunderland, I'm from Sunderland, I cover Sunderland. All of my friends are Sunderland fans. All of my family are Sunderland fans. Everybody I know that is a Sunderland fan, pretty much. Everybody I walk down the street and speak to is a Sunderland fan. Like, it is not in my interest to be shit-stirring. I can assure you of that.
Yeah. One of the questions is, obviously, there's a lot of, I won't say emotions that come with covering Sunderland, but what is the most enjoyable part of, you know, covering Sunderland, and what is the most frustrating part?
Most enjoyable part would be when the club is doing really well and it's on the up. So, like, any sort of trip to Wembley is always amazing. Just winning games generally is really fun. Like, there's a lot of work goes into match days with graphics and start 11 graphics and player quotes, manager quotes, covering the game, match reports, player ratings. So when a match day is going good, that's a real, real buzz. And I don't want people to take this the wrong way, but there is some, like, perverse enjoyment. And I actually feel like fans will relate to this as well, but there is a perverse enjoyment when there's, like, a new manager coming in or a manager hunt, that excitement, if that makes sense. You're never happy, really, to see a manager lose the job, obviously.
Yeah.
But the buzz that comes around the sort of what next chat, or like a takeover, some, like when Kira Louis-Dreyfus was on his way in, and, you know, we thought Methven and Donald were on the way out fully, but it turns out they weren't. But any sort of stuff like that's really, really exciting. Even, like, I wouldn't say I enjoyed it, but the sort of, you do get the rush of a major news story when it was like the Black Cats Bar thing was just insane, because, like, within an hour, it was, like, being reported up and down the country. And then overnight, it reached America and all of that sort of stuff. And it was like, blimey, we're on the, you know, the cold face of a major sort of international sports story in a way. Yes, it wasn't so massive that it dominated the headlines for days, but the reach of that story went sort of far and wide. So you do get enjoyment from all of that sort of stuff. But on the flip side of that, what I will say is it's then really tough, sort of the added scrutiny that everything comes under when something like that does happen. So, you know, when that news first broke, a lot of Sunderland fans were saying to me and other colleagues, like, the club needs to be asked about this. The club needs to be asked about this. Absolutely agree. You know, as a Sunderland fan, I was upset with that situation as much as anybody. And I think I probably lazily made the point and probably miscommunicated it in a way, which was my own fault, but I was sort of spitballing on Twitter, which you should never do. And my point was, well, there's no real point asking Michael Beale about it because it's not in his remit. Yeah. And if we got the chance to talk to Christian Speakman about it, it's not really in his remit. My point was that actually you'd probably need to speak to Kira Louis-Dreyfus and Steve Davison, neither of which really do interviews. So I sort of said that in a lazy, haphazard way. And a few people took umbrage and said, like, oh, you're refusing to sort of ask the tough questions and you're trying to sort of skate around it. I was just saying that, you know, the two people that we could really ask that we get any sort of FaceTime with, probably not in their remit, but I do accept that obviously it was a, you know, a very, very sort of tender situation that people really, really wanted to hear from the club. So that sort of stuff, while it's a good buzz, is never really nice. And obviously when Sunderland are losing football games, it's absolutely rubbish. Like some of the times in League One, you were just thinking like, ugh. And Phil, if you think my colleague Phil went to all of those games as well, I was lucky enough that I didn't have to go to all of those games because I wasn't always rotated in, if that makes sense. So all of your like Papa John's trophy games away from home and stuff like that, and the ones at home against, you know, Leicester's under-23s and Man United's under-21s, where we were sort of barely scraping by or losing or something, you know, that wasn't pleasant to see. The club in the doldrums wasn't great. The Charlie Methven thing and the divisiveness that him and Stuart Donald caused and the infighting amongst fans on social media, that was horrendous, I thought. Just to see a really proud fan base sort of, you know, eating itself, it was yeah. Tough to watch. I think, like a person like Jack Ross, and I always come back to Jack Ross because he was the first Sunderland manager that I ever dealt with, and I really, really liked him. That didn't mean I wouldn't criticise him, but he was very kind to me when I was interviewing him because I was a nervous wreck at sometimes, and I actually asked some ridiculous questions as well, but he just used to smile and answer them as best that he could, which was always really appreciated. So to see somebody like that get sacked, or somebody like Tony Mowbray, who's like a fantastic bloke, whilst you accept that, you know, they're there to be shot at and they're judged on results, and in Jack Ross's case probably deserve to go, it's tough to see people that are actually really nice blokes. It's tough to see them get criticised so much. A lot of it is justified, 100%. A lot of it is justified. Some of it strays into bad taste. You've seen that with Michael Beale as well. You know, criticise him all you want, criticise away. I think that's good.
There's definitely a point where criticism becomes abuse.
100%. And we should all be careful and mindful. I think that's a really tough part of the job, is seeing that criticism come people's way and knowing that they're going through the ringer. I think it's... But I suppose that's life at the end of the day.
Yeah. One more question I'll ask you before we wrap it up, and it's going to be completely relevant to everything we've just talked about. Birmingham is the next game, of course. Tony Mowbray reunion. Alex Pritchard was to be reunion. I think he might still miss the game with injury. Deion Sanderson, potential reunion. Joe Bellingham, reunion. And I think that's about it. Christian Speakman as well, if you want to throw that one in there as well. So it's a game Sunderland have to win. And the last question I will ask you is, what are your score predictions for that game tomorrow?
I think it's a tough one. I don't know. It's a really tough one to call away from home. Tony Mowbray knows Sunderland quite well. Against Huddersfield, Sunderland were pretty bad. You know, they're struggling to put 90 minutes together. Even in the games they've won, they've been bad in large parts of it. Obviously, the first half against Plymouth, pretty bad. You know, even the Stoke win, they were rubbish. Preston were rubbish. Hull, that was terrible at the Stadium of Light. And then at their place, they should have beat us, in my opinion. So I reckon Mowbray's got our number and it could be 1-0 or 2-0.
I think I would agree with that.
The script's written, isn't it, for him to come back and haunt us? Like, it really, really is.
It's always been a Sunderland thing for an ex-manager/player to haunt us. Obviously, Alex Neil did it early in the season, didn't he?
He did.
So, been interesting one to watch. But, of course, that's tomorrow, time of listening, Saturday at 3 o'clock, kickoff away to Birmingham. We'll have a podcast out to talk about that game, get some of the reaction to that game, and then a brief look ahead to what I think is a midweek game against Leicester.
I think so.
Better check. But we'll have, like I said, we'll be a podcast out to discuss that game against Birmingham, everything about the game, team selection, which I think will definitely be a key factor in that as well, and just briefly check in to see if Sunderland do play midweek. Don't think they do. I think it might be the week after. But we will be back to talk about that Birmingham game. But until then, we will see you later. That's all, folks.